Hey, what's up, everybody? It's a Saturday show with Mark and Dave on Tone Talk. How you doing? It's episode 148, and we've got a fantastic guest that we've been waiting for a while. We've got Nolly, who is a man who covers many hats, I'd say, wears many hats. He's a producer, product development, he's a musician. He was in Periphery, he developed Good Drums. He has a signature bass, I believe, five-string bass. We'll get into that. So, Adam, Nolly, how are you?
They're both my names, and I thought it was a funny introduction because I literally never wear hats, but I appreciate the
picking me up. I don't either.
it's really cool to be on. I was saying before the show that I've spent quite a lot of time watching you guys geeking out about stuff, so it's really nice to be on.
Awesome.
Some are better than others.
Yes. Do you ever go back and watch Dave any time?
No, I don't want some of them. I don't want to see.
They were longer before, right? Did you used to go on a bit longer?
Yeah, we've grown old and tired. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we still would necessarily if it goes down that path, but you know, it's kind of, we're trying to keep it to like 2 hours or under now.
Generally it's more speaking. Manageable. Yeah, it's tough. Even on my back, just sitting in the chair for 2 hours is enough without getting up. You know,
4 hour shows,
they were brutal.
Generally, go down Well, you have to have enough to talk about. You got to have enough to not run out of stuff to talk about. And with some guests, that is the case. You know, we can.
But
as I remember, some of those early ones had a bit of alcohol involved as well.
Well, I was about to, that's exactly what I was about to say. The alcohol, absolutely. The alcohol definitely had something to do with it.
Everyone likes to watch a train wreck.
They do. That's why the Jake E. Lee episode is up there.
How many views are on that thing now?
Over 300,000.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is amazing.
And people email me all the time and they go, that's my favorite episode you ever did. I'm like, oh God, I can't even watch it after the.
It's scary to think that 300,000 people have watched that, or it's gotten 300,000 views. Because, at times it was like, holy shit, that's kind of cringy. You know, like it's the stories. Yeah, some of the stuff was just like, oh my God,
that's what makes it good.
Yes, exactly.
What makes it? The thing is about doing it live, you know, is always it's like, well, it's live.
It's live.
Yeah, whatever it's said, well, it already got said. There's no taking it out, really, or at least generally.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's only been less than a handful of times that we've had to make an edit to a video in this almost 7 years that we've been doing this. So, which is good. They've all always been live. So my first question right off the bat is how did you get the name Nolly? How does that, where does that come from?
It's a really, you know, the answer is so boring, and it's literally just, it's a nickname that's followed me from high school. I changed high school, and before people knew my name at the new school, they kind of just came up with this name for me, and it stuck. Teachers called me that, and then I went to university, and a whole load of new people, there was no reason for it to carry on, but somehow it followed me, and then it just kind of kept on rolling and rolling, so Nolly it is. But as I was saying before the show, I kind of introduced myself to people as Adam, because I don't know, it's a bit odd introducing yourself by your own nickname. But a lot of people wouldn't even know who you were talking about if you started talking about Adam instead of Nolly. So it's useful to retain it at the same time.
I get it. Well, Dave, when we were talking the other day, when you said you were off working with The Offspring, you were like, okay, well, yeah, I talked to Noodles.
Yeah.
And you're like, he'll come, you know, he'll be coming on. And I'm like, oh, that'd be cool. And then I'm thinking, okay, Noodles, where'd that come from? And it seems like that's a common nickname for him that's been going on for years too, right?
Yeah, and Dexter also, you know.
Oh, yeah.
His name's Brian Holland, and Noodles is Kevin. Hey, what is his name? Let's see.
Offspring Unmasked at the moment, is it?
I think people know Wasserman. Yeah. Is his last name, so. I thought that's what it was. I just wanted to check before I said something wrong. Which I don't address them by that.
You go by Noodles.
I go by Noodles.
Okay. Yeah.
And Dexter. So I know I've known them since the mid 90s. You know, I've done work for them since then.
When I was younger, my nickname was Ski.
Oh, yeah?
As a Husansky.
Well, so there, you're in trouble now.
Or when I was, exactly. Or when I was in my band, they called me Bones. Because I used to smoke too many bones.
You have to put in parentheses next to your name now. Wait, what did you say? Sorry.
I said you had to lead me through that one. I didn't catch it otherwise.
Yeah.
I got it in the end.
That's what they, yes, exactly. anyway, we got a couple of questions right off the bat, and I promise you guys we will get to them. We do want to dive into some things. So, Nolly, were you at NAMM? Did you go?
I was not. I have not been for quite a long time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
I prefer to connect with the companies and people that I work with in person more directly, I think. But I get it from the company side. It's very useful to kind of have all those meetings with everyone. But for me, I think for a lot of people, it kind of just feels like an episode of Dude, Where's My Car? Where it's like, you're just trying to get from one place to another and constantly getting diverted and never actually accomplishing your
goal. Oh, you think? Yeah. Yeah. I really noticed that this year. Just like trying to get to my friend's booth or something was like, people are stopping me along the way. Like, going, I almost want to wear a disguise
more and more
next
of a public
time.
Face, aren't you?
Yeah.
Like more and more people know what you look like.
Yes. Yes. That I guess is an unfortunate thing, or fortunate. I don't know how you look at it.
Yeah. Oh. Well, you're recognized, but that's tough. So you know what we should right off the bat before I forget, we should do our sponsors and dive right into Sweetwater. Make sure you guys check out sweetwater.com. We have a link below, which is our affiliate link. You could use that for purchasing anything on Sweetwater. And I think right now we should probably like feature what they offer for your products, Nolly. You know, I think that
would probably be pretty.
So we've got Get Good Drums. So tell us about this. So right off the bat, like how did you start this? And, you know, people can buy your software and, you know, I'm really curious.
Yeah. I mean, it started really, really small, really humble kind of thing. Myself and the drummer in Periphery, Matt, had an idea. I'd kind of gotten, you know, I was building my chops as a producer, doing lots of recording of drums, getting into some rooms that I probably didn't quite deserve to be in just because of the fact I was in Periphery, and kind of I would use tour as the ideal time to really kind of get to grips with drums. So I'd basically tech Matt's drums. I'd tune them all the time. We got to the point where Matt was like, my drums are sounding amazing every night. We should like record samples of this. And we floated it to a couple of companies who had kind of shown interest, but then, you know, it was going to take ages to come out. And we kind of thought, why don't we just give it a go ourselves, see what happens if we actually just try and do it off our own backs. And if it's rubbish, we don't put it out. And if it's got some potential, then we do. And it came out surprisingly well. You know, still the very first products always don't have quite the same refinement as the later ones. But, you know, we were really impressed with how our efforts kind of translated on the first product. And then pretty quickly kind of launched a second one, which you can see is the first on that list, called Modern and Massive, which is still our biggest selling. That was actually the second product we ever did. And that one seems to have just kind of, I guess it's kind of got to that point where it's just got a bit of a life of its own, where people are kind of talking about it by word of mouth and spreading it around that way. So even though it's not one that we've necessarily promoted for a while, it's just, it's consistently our biggest seller. And that's like a whole load of modern rock kind of sounding drums. So kind of bigger sizes in a really explosive sounding room. And it's just, you know, it's just kind of snowballed from there. Matt and I are still partners. We've also got Dez, who is a touring guitarist and producer in a band we toured with a lot called Good Tiger. And also Misha from Periphery, who you've had on the show.
Yeah.
Well, that's how I heard of the partners in the company.
That's how I heard about you first. I mean, geez, and it's been like years since we had Misha on the show, you know.
It has been, yeah.
And so he mentioned it a long time ago. So it's been, you've been on the list for a long time to have on the show, and I'm really glad you came on.
Yeah, I remember talking to Misha. I was like, damn, I'd love to be on there, because right around there, I was watching Tone Talk all the time. Anyway, I'll let you do your thing.
No, this is great. I mean, this is really cool that, you know, so anybody who is, you know, watching right now, you guys just go on Sweetwater through our link and look up Get Good Drums, and you can download the software. Like, literally, if you wanted to get the modern and massive pack, it's delivered in minutes. You just use our link and you can download any of these drum packs. So, and these obviously will work in any DAW system, you know, and
they're based out, like, so there's an infrastructure called Kontakt, which is like it's a sampler made by Native Instruments, who are one of the big software companies.
Okay.
So these are kind of coded for that. But you don't need, they have like a paid version and they have a free version of Kontakt, and ours works with the free. So there's no extra cost involved. You just need to download that and then you can get hold of our packs. We've also done some like Cab IR products and recently a bass library as well. So, and Cab IRs is like a huge thing for me. I've done the IRs for GTD, which are kind of deep dives into different speaker types, like, you know, all the different greenbacks, including, you know, I'd love to get talking with you, Dave, about all the various greenbacks and how they sound and all that kind of stuff. Vintage 30s, you know, down the rabbit hole with all the vintage 30s.
Oh, yeah.
And also I've done a lot of the IRs for Neural DSP, like a lot of their software products, and also like the majority of the ones that came default on their quad cortex modeler as well, the ones that I did. While listening to you guys, a lot of the time I have you guys piped into my headphones while I'm just laboriously, you know, sampling and listening to some tone geeking.
We'll get into the speaker thing in a second.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure,
that'll be fun.
Yeah. So, and then also they're offering your Dingwall guitar, your signature bass, the five string bass, which is super cool.
Yeah. It also comes in a 4 and a 6.
Cool.
Yeah, and that's quite a recent thing, actually, that Sweetwater have taken that on. So it's quite opportune. If we had done this call earlier, they wouldn't have been on Sweetwater.
Perfect.
Yep. So just, guys, make sure, you know, check out, I think this month, I guess, is Kontakt Creator Sale for the month. It ends on February 23rd. You get 5% back special financing. So check out Sweetwater, all right? And then also we've got fixpedalboards.com. Make sure you go to fixpedalboards.com for upgrading your pedal boards, and as well as Tomon. Okay. So check out Tomon. We have links for everybody in our description for the videos. All right. So, diving right in, let's talk about IRs. So you developed IRs during the pandemic. Is that what you said you were doing?
Yeah. I'd kind of gotten into, we'd done one IR pack before the pandemic. We partnered with Zilla Cabs. Are you familiar with Zilla Cabs?
Yep.
It's like a custom cab maker in the UK. He's an old friend and contact of mine. And we basically got like one of each or most of the different cab types he does. Went to a studio and sampled them with various speakers in them. And then just before the pandemic, my wife and I had moved into like a place where I could make loads of noise without disturbing anyone. And so I set up like a kind of booth of sub traps in my mix room. And it was just like, especially once the pandemic hit, was just on eBay all day long, buying cabs and speakers and then lugging them up to my mix room and sampling them there. And that kind of ended up, you know, bearing the fruit of, I forget how many, like 50 different cab speaker options for Neural DSP. And then I really went down the rabbit hole with the vintage 30 sound, which is a bit of a debate. And there was so much kind of conflicting info and just kind of,
oh my God, all over the place, right? It's just like endless and at nauseam almost.
It is. And I think I actually kind of got to the bottom of quite a lot of it. There's like been these voicing changes, and just through sheer numbers that I bought and kind of really analyzing them, you could kind of see like, okay, here the voicing seems to change. And when I say here, I mean, you don't know that speaker was the exact point, but you know, around this period, there seems to be like a voicing change and then another voicing change.
So let's talk about that.
Yeah. Totally.
Let's go down that rabbit hole. Tell us what you know.
So what did you
on the vintage 30 specifically?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and a lot of it translates because it's about manufacturing changes that kind of, you know, a lot of the same cones used on the Good Celestian speakers. So the things that I found out were that a lot of people were attributing tone changes to like Chinese versus UK manufacturing, and I don't believe that that's the major factor in the change of the voicing. I think there's a bit of a red herring thing where the voicing changed due to other changes in the paper pulp at a very similar period to once Celestian started outsourcing or, you know, set up their Chinese operation, which was like around 2001. So I think that got a lot of people confused about it being the fact that they were made in China rather than something about the paper specification. Right. And I think a lot of people get really hung up on Celestium kind of refusing to say that there has been a change. And I think I get it from an engineering perspective, like their spec of the speaker hasn't changed. They don't, you know, sprinkle any secret seasoning on the ones that go to Mesa Boogie or anything like that. But I mean, Dave, you know that in production facility, you know, they'll separate off different, tolerances, you know, like a certain manufacturer might request that higher tolerance, like Mesa Boogie might say, we need ours within like this really specific tolerance. So certain ones will be, you know, will be sectioned off for Mesa Boogie to use. And then other manufacturers will want to buy for cheaper and maybe they have a wider tolerance on them. So, you know, I do think there's something to be said for, you know, some brands seem to consistently have a specific sound, and but I really think it's to do with tolerances rather than there being a different specification for them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so, you know, just in terms of the voicing, you can hear, if you go back to when they first kind of came out, 86, 87, the Marshall vintages, they seem to have more of what I call the greenback equality, which is like the kind of blackback, Kurt Muller, greenback character, where it's got a little bit more air on the top, a little bit more scooped in the mids, like a little bit more woody sounding.
Now, let me stop you just for a second. Yeah. Sorry. So when you say the Marshall vintage, mm-hmm. So there's the Marshall vintage speaker with the silver basket,
yeah,
versus the actual vintage 30 that came out at the time with the gold basket.
Yeah.
Now, to me, those were different speakers. They sounded very different.
I believe that the only change is the frame, and that the problem is if you sample anything other than the same cone batch, not, you know, not even the batch code of when the speaker left Celestion, but like the batch of the paper. I think it's only when you get to that kind of granularity that you can start to be like, actually, these sound pretty similar.
Okay.
And also, obviously, the fact that most of the Marshall vintages out there are 16 ohm for Marshall uses. And mm-hmm. Lots of people take a 16 ohm cab, or, you know, cab with 16 ohm speakers, chuck it next to a cab with 8 ohm speakers and go, oh, you know, different speakers. But as you well know, like, it's a very different.
It sounds different.
It totally sounds different. You need a different weight in the voice coil for the different ohmages and everything. So yeah, the difficulty is just getting a direct comparison. And I managed to get it with a few speakers. It's so difficult, you know, to nail down, especially in the early days when the cones just had like the model code printed on them, like 444 or 1777. Didn't give you any more information than that. It's around like 2004-ish that they started to add like an actual date code, like D27, I don't know, just off the top of my head, like a batch code for the cone that you can reference and actually then see, like, you know, two different quads of speakers, like these actually have the same paper batch in the cone. And those, you know, you really do get down to the point where it's like there's a variance anyway, like we're talking about a really inconsistent material, like paper pulp. It's 60s era material, and they all tend to sound different anyway, but you do kind of get these bigger kind of voicing changes. And there's a guy in Germany, he's a Irish guy, am I right? Anyway, he's living in Germany and he's done really scientific testing of this. And he's actually kind of put a lot of my theories that I put forward in a previous vintage 30 to the test. Sorry, in a previous video about vintage 30s to the test. And he seems to have pretty much agreed with everything I say, which is like around about 2000, the top end just really darkens off on the sound of the speaker.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, through the 90s, they're pretty consistent. I mean, it's not, there are differences, but you can't really draw any conclusions from it. But there's around like 2000, they get noticeably darker. In 2001, the high end just falls off a cliff on some of them. Like I've got a couple of Mesa cabs where if you don't have a microphone right in the middle at the brightest spot, it just sounds like you put a blanket over the speaker. I know this to be the case, that there was a bit of pushback, especially from Mesa Boogie, about the voicing changing so much. And then they kind of tried to stabilize back into a slightly brighter voicing, but it's kind of come through in different ways where it's like, you know, some are more upper mid-rangey, some are more airy. And you know, like through the kind of early 2000s, they all tend to sound pretty good up till 2004, but you get like these, some sound a bit more kind of like industrial, a bit more scrapey, some sound really smooth, like ones from around 2003, I can't be that specific, but you know, around 2003 seem to sound really smooth and nice. Those are excellent sounding speakers. And then around 2005, they start to get really industrial sounding, and then at some point they just kind of change voicing a lot and they sound more like a modern one now. I think there's actually pretty consistent all the way back to about 2007 till the modern day. Like every batch does sound different, but they all have a slightly different kind of sound to them than those ones from kind of 2000 to 2005, which I refer to as the golden era. Some people have come at me saying like, oh, I've done millions of records with my 2007s. What are you talking about? And I'm not saying that any other era doesn't sound good, but for me, I came up listening to the recordings of guys like Andy Sneap, who you've got, mm-hmm. you've had on the podcast. He's a huge tone hero, and Colin Richardson, who used a lot of Andy's equipment at the time.
Actually, we haven't had Andy on.
Have you not?
No.
I thought we had Andy on.
Yeah, we should have Andy on.
Oh, I'm getting confused then. Yeah, you should. He's a fantastic guy and just amazing tones. His Mesa Boogie Cab comes from 2000, and I started talking to producers and like getting the serial codes off their Mesa 412s and getting them to open them up and tell me what batch codes were on the speakers. And like I actually like got an Excel sheet together so I can track pretty well if you tell me the serial code of your Mesa cab, like which era of vintage 30s it should have in it. And there's like a huge cluster of the guys getting the best tones. Their cabs come from like 2000 through till 2003. And pretty much everyone that says like, I've got an amazing sounding Mesa Boogie cab for metal, it's pretty much always from that era or before, but often so worn in that kind of airy top end isn't so present anymore.
Right.
Yeah. That's a long monologue.
It seems like the newer ones are can be excessively top endy. Presency, almost sizzly in some nature. When I never remember the old ones.
A bit more like 1K as well, like a bit more.
Yeah, I never remember old ones being like that at all.
No, they're not.
And although yet some people have been saying the newest ones have a little rolled off now.
Yeah, so that guy I mentioned that's done the testing.
Yeah.
He tested that theory. I think so. He went and got. He's just as geeky about it, probably more.
I think
than
I saw the video, so I think I know.
Did you? Okay. About, yeah. So he found that there was indeed like a batch where they seemed to get a bit darker again, but then the next ones out, like he got like the next, you know, one from a few months later, and it was kind of back to the voicing. So I think
it's not Johan Segborn or
no,
it's not. He's very greenback focused. I love Johan's videos. I've learned a lot from those. No, it's a guy who goes by the other John Brown, because there's a guitarist called John Brown who plays in a band that's very adjacent to Periphery called Monuments. And he's quite well known. So I guess this other guy who has the same name often got mistaken for that John Brown. So yeah, he's literally called the other John Brown on YouTube. you should definitely check out his channel.
I saw that long video.
Wow. Yeah, you did?
Long, vintage 30 like video.
Yeah.
I actually wish they were a little more rolled off.
I mean, yeah, I like it. It seems to be around like 5-6K, just where like the fizzy frequencies are,
right.
You know, just before the kind of roll off in every speaker. And those old speakers, man, they work so well.
Does it change? I guess the answer would be yes, but even if you buy a new speaker, you break it in, it's that's going to change the tone over time, right?
Oh yeah,
it does, but not necessarily in like super predictable ways. Like actually the same guy recently did like a break-in test with vintage 30s and found that actually some of them got harsher like as they broke in and seemed to stabilize.
I saw that one
and, like,
too.
Yeah, so
I've done that test with a 4x12 that I broke in kind of a very archaic way, but I can make noise here. So, you know, I just simply put a guitar riff through a 100-watt Marshall with the cabinet facing to the ground and then left for 2 hours at a time, let it rest for a while, and then, I mean, full up.
Yeah.
Abusing it to no end, and would leave for 2 hours, come back, listen to it, leave again, record some of it, leave again, come back, 2 hours. And every time I came back, it seemed to get better. I don't know. It made a difference. And also the doping around the edge of a speaker can make a huge difference. So if they change this doping, or they have more doping or less doping, is going to change how that speaker sounds completely.
What is dope? What's doping?
Around the edge, outer edge of the speaker. It's like it looks like a black tar almost, thing around the edge of the speaker. And remember years ago, matchless amplifiers used to take the doping or most of the doping off. it would take some acetone and wipe it away. That's going to cause the tone to move more freely, and it's going to cause a change in tone. You could also potentially get ghost notes and things, though. So more don't cry and stuff.
So it's kind of acting like a muffler in a way.
It keeps the cone from just bouncing out of the frame.
I see.
It's kind of over the folds around the edge, like at the outside edge. It's like sometime on some speakers, it seems to come like further down onto the actual cone. And some brands have really thick, like the Warehouse Veteran 30, like the doping looks like PVC, almost like there's a rubble all around the speaker. And you can really hear that, I think, in the darkness of those speakers, for example.
Interesting. Mm. We have not gone down this rabbit hole, I don't think.
No. Well, then you can all get about, then you can go geekier and start getting into the where you're placing the mic.
Oh, for sure.
Well, yeah, that's obviously. Yeah. And what mic are you using?
Well, and let's talk about that one for a minute.
Yeah.
I know you, Pete Thorne was saying that you have a, that it sounds different from where the wires come up and glue into the edge of the cone versus.
One second. I've actually, this is not planned, but I have a speaker here. So I can literally show you. And I said it to a Celestian engineer. I was like, is this a thing? And they were like, oh yeah, it's a thing. Of course. Like, nobody seems to talk about it, but like, yeah. So this is this a Heritage?
Heritage Greenback?
This is a Heritage Greenback. Yeah. So where the cables come off, sorry, getting about focus here, where they come off here, they kind of go from the terminals and actually just like go through eyelets in the cone.
Mm-hmm. And then those little
stripes there.
Right.
Like, close to 90 degrees. It's not quite 90 degrees. Yeah, so basically the cone's like being damped. Like if you're a drummer, you know what a moon gel does to a drum.
Uh-huh. Right? Absolutely.
Like this is way thinner than a drum head. It's vibrating, you know, like crazy. And you're adding damping at these two spots here. So it really changes the vibration patterns across the cone. It kind of dampens high end a bit like moon gel on a drum or something. Hmm. And so when you're close miking, you know, Celestian, I think they do their speakers in just free air, like hanging off a chain and like mic it from a couple of meters away or something for their reference test or something. So arguably at that distance, you're hearing like more of like the sum of what's coming off the speaker. But when you've got like a vintage 57, like this close to the speaker, if you're pointing it, standard mic position, most people's go to is like kind of where the cone meets the dust cap, like around the edge there. And so if you're kind of going around rotationally, you'll notice it gets a lot smoother sounding. You kind of lose high end when you start getting close to where those eyelets are, because they're literally dampening the movement of the cone. Like, it's just a physical phenomenon. And that can be good or bad. I found that for high gain, at least, it's a really, it's a good idea to go close to those. They do a little bit of like similar thing to the difference between the new and old vintage 30s, where that like fizz region just gets nipped back a little bit.
Do you put it in between the two? Or
anywhere close to do the thing. Yeah. And I mean, unless you have a robot mic stand, which I do, but I don't bother using that on a lot of sessions. It's really useful for impulses, but a bit long the rest of the time. You know, somewhere close to there tends to sound really good. And, mm-hmm. you know, it depends on the amp and what you're going for and the sound of the speaker. Like those very, very dark V30s from 2001 I was talking about, they're like almost unusable if you go exactly on there. So those are one speaker where if I'm not miking dead center, I'm probably going to go the other way. Hmm. But it's worth knowing too, like how the cab's wired up internally, because that's going to, you know, that's where the terminals are. So on like a Marshall cab, I think they're wired. Yeah, they're wired horizontally.
Yeah.
Like two pairs like that. Mm-hmm. So that means that when you're looking at the front of the speaker, it's kind of going to be, the inside, exactly. And most companies do it that way, but then Mesa Boogie have their speakers done so that they have like a kind of, the baskets make a cross pattern instead of an X. Mm-hmm. So in those cases, it kind of, it's like these brackets internally, like kind of going, you know, to the side and down on the inside edge of the speaker. So that makes a really big difference. And if you're multi-miking the same speaker as well, it's really worth knowing, because there typically isn't enough space to get two mics on the same bit there. So you might want to prioritize for like your brightest sounding mic to be closer to one of these, or mm-hmm. if you want a really bright sound, you know, you can go the other way. So it's really good info to have. And I think it accounts for a lot of different experiences that people have. With a lot of the products and a lot of the things that become products for GGD, it's come out of like my own frustrations of getting a great sound kind of, just by luck in the studio, and then taking that exact same gear to another studio and not being able to get the same sound, and, trying all the things that people talk about, different mic pre's and stuff, which makes really subtle differences, differences anyway, and being like, but that's not the thing that's taking, this sound all the way from what it was to what it's not now. And then kind of coming across these things, it was like, why is no one talking about this? Like, no one talks about this when they're talking about close miking a speaker, but it's so obvious. And I actually did a video, I think, for the GGD YouTube, where I kind of showed a comparison with the robot mic stand that's moving the exact same distance on either side of the center, and it's clear as day.
Wow. Yeah. That's
I'll say too, if you've got like a T75 or a G1265 or any like a K100, any of the ones that have large dust caps, the terminals are still there. They're just hidden by the dust cap, so it's a little bit more difficult to see them. So it's not that they're not there or anything. I think you have to get into like some pretty radical different speaker design by different brands before you get to the to companies that are not doing it that way, kind of threading eyelets through the speaker.
I have an old vintage. Go ahead.
Yeah.
What were you going to say there?
I have an old vintage cab that has 65s, the original, right? 65s from the 70s in it.
Base cones or lead cones?
I think they're lead cones.
The lead cones? Because a lot of people prefer the base cones on the 65.
That's a good question. I might need to look at that.
And they're not one of the crazy ones with like aluminium dust cap or
nothing like that. Just the first era that they put in, standard Marshall checkerboard cab, once they moved from the black back into the 65.
Right.
Speaker.
So silver label with a vented voice coil at the back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because they did the 65s for a long period of time, didn't they? Like, if you tell someone to just go and grab some G1265s, it could be a really wide range of different tones, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, then I think that was like the standard higher power speaker that they used starting sometime in the 70s. I'm not sure what year exactly. And then they moved.
Coincided with the JMP, am I wrong?
Yeah. Maybe
like when they moved to master volume Marshall.
So that could have been around 76 ish or something.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. Those were cool though. I have one cab like that and another vintage cab with a particularly good black back sounding cab.
And that's what you're right. Those are H magnet ones, right?
Not H.
No.
M. G12M75, but black back. And this particular era, this particular cab sounded really good.
I like the IR that you came out with that.
That was a different. That was the 30-watt H.
Oh,
in that cab that's in our pack, and that's in our, comes with the IRX pedal. Yeah,
with the IRX. But didn't you also do one in your previous cab pack?
Yeah, that's the cab. Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't do a black back cab because Pete Thorne did his black back cab.
Oh, okay.
So I just left that off, but I can do it later if I do another cab pack.
Gotcha. So,
Dave, you were one person when we're talking about greenbacks. I heard you and I heard Johan Sekerborn talking about 6402 cones.
Yeah.
On greenbacks. I've got a few sets of those actually.
Yeah.
Is that your cab that's not got Tolex on? Is that the one that has the 6402s in it?
I need to verify that. So the greenbacks that are in that cab came from the first reissue greenbacks in the 90s at some point.
Yeah.
Early 90s, I would say, probably 93-ish.
I've got some 89 reissue greenbacks.
Yeah, could be.
And those ones actually don't have, they don't say anything on the cone.
I need to really open the cab up and double check the cone. I have kind of assumed it was a 6402 cone, mm-hmm. but I have not verified that. That cab's been around for a long time, and I can't kill those speakers. I've tried. We've tried to kill them. Nothing's ever happened to them. And the cab, It's a really good sounding cab. It's got a nice smooth top end on it. At times you might think too smooth, but it actually doesn't mic that way. It mics nicely.
That's cool. Yeah, the 642s for me, they really do resemble like the Blackback Kurt Muller cones. I mean, it's like what, a 10-year gap, same producer. It seems like not much change with the cone recipe. It seems like they pretty much just got back into the swing of things with the Greenback, yeah. But they are pretty inconsistent. Like I think I've had 3 or 4 quads of them. And a couple of them sound like a couple of the cabs sound similar, and then there's like a couple that just sound totally.
What are your thoughts on new Greenbacks?
Haven't got on too well with them. I've liked the Heritage H, and I don't necessarily like older H's. Actually, I don't like
the all the Heritage H, is gone them. Now.
Yes, I know. Which is interesting.
So you just have the standard UK made again Greenback now.
So we did a cab pack of Greenbacks for GGD. Everything, you know, from early Pulsonic, later Pulsonic, what's it called? The transition era where Celestion made their own cones, you know, Creamback, Whiteback. We had like everything you could imagine multiples of in the studio. And we had like a 2012 set of Heritages and like a really recent set of Heritages as well. Those were M25s. Mm-hmm. And the last one that we liked was a 2003. And actually that was our favorite. And from the people that bought the pack, I know that that's the cab that most people go to. And I think that relates to what I was saying about that period in the 2000s with the vintage 30s too. They just sound actually a bit smoother than the rest of the Greenbacks. And when you mic them up, you know what they remind me of is the Lynchbacks actually, which might be a speaker that you know.
Lynchbacks was a great speaker.
And, you know, George kind of came out, I think, saying, well, he said he liked, what was it, Greenbacks, but also Fane speakers and wanted the best of those. But I think if they'd have marketed as like the in-between of a vintage 30 and a Greenback, that would have been pretty accurate and probably would have captured more people's attention.
But I mean, that seems to be what that speaker is to me. Mm. It literally is kind of a hybrid between a Greenback and a vintage 30 in sound to me.
Yeah. What about the EVH speakers that they came out with?
So the EVH speakers, from what I've been told, were 20-watt Heritage Greenbacks with no changes other than the back and the terminals. They weren't like the Heritage terminals. And supposedly they're still that same, but I don't know. I haven't gone down that path. Does that sound different than the reissue Greenback?
No, I think they're identical. I think they literally are. Just they will have a different T code from Celestion because it's you know, different basket and the different terminals and everything, but they're the Heritage cones. Same thing as a 16-watt Heritage.
But now that they've gotten rid of the Heritage, I guess you can still get the EVH.
You can get the EVH and you can get the standard Greenback. That's the only speakers. I've been talking their ear off about, why don't you do a Blackback? Why don't you do this?
I mean, I can't speak for Celestin, but from the things which I've found out, it's not easy or, let's say, environmentally friendly in some cases to recreate the paper pulp that was used.
Yeah.
You know, for one, you'd have to like, because I spoke to them a little bit about the vintage 30s I liked, and they were like, you know, we can analyze what's going on in the paper pulp, but we'll need to like tear the cone out. And like, that speaker's dead. So it's like a choice of like, do you send them the best sounding speaker you've ever heard for them to destroy in the hope that maybe they'll replicate it? Or do you just hold on to it, you know?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
You can probably guess which way I went with that.
You kept it.
Yeah,
absolutely. Exactly.
It's like, you know, it's really geeky stuff about like paper pulp length distribution, you know, like how fluffy the fibers of the wood pulp are when they, you know, all that stuff makes a difference to you know, the way it kind of forms as a speaker. And then the way that the cone itself is shaped has a big impact on the sound. I think there's certain things that Kurt Muller that made the Blackbacks and still make the Celestion speakers just, it's not interesting to them to do because they're making really high tech carbon fiber speakers in their factory. And they've got like the guitarist asking them to make this speaker that was born out of the 50s out of paper. You know, it's like Stone Age technology to them. So I don't think they're about to retool to recreate like a Blackback cone, especially if it's not as efficient to produce.
And maybe there's other companies that could do it.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I always go down that path. You know, like the guys at Eminence were up talking to me at the NAMM show, and I'm just like, okay, yeah, I still never heard a speaker I like from you, but
oh wow!
But that new Mick Thompson one has a Kurt Mueller cone.
Yeah,
I was like looking at it. I'm like, look at that.
And that makes all the difference. The cone really is huge.
Yeah. The only thing is, though, I was, you know, this, the clips I've heard of that speaker sound reasonably good, but they're quite rolled off in the top end compared to almost maybe too much for me, maybe. And I hate it when something starts sounding like a wah is starting to be cocked on. It's not my favorite kind of sound. And it almost sounds a little bit like that.
I mean, I guess it's like the higher gain you play, maybe the better that can sound. I still think there's a point where it doesn't sound good. Like a K100, I've never liked that for high gain, or really in general. But you know, those really rolled off large dust cap speakers don't really do it for me.
Right.
But you know, for example, this kind of what I'm calling a golden era of vintage 30s, they do just reduce that kind of fizz zone really nicely, so that when you plug a 5150, you know, classically into it, that just gives you like the sound of metal for the last 25, 30 years. Hmm. And you plug it into a more modern speaker, and there's just noise. It's just like going on up there that sits like a hat on top of the tone. And as a recording engineer, you end up taking out, but
right,
it's just not there in those other speakers.
I should dive into some of these questions. We've got a lot of questions here.
Cool. Yeah, do it.
Rax Effects, thanks for the super chat. He says, "Hey, Tone Talkers, can you please try to get Obeid Khan from Khan Amps MPEG designer on the show? I've never heard of him, but Dave, I'm sure you know him, right?"
Oh, I think he's also the Magnetone guy. Am I not correct in thinking that?
I don't know.
Yeah, I know who he is. I met him once.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not friends with him, but I know I met him once.
I just added him to the list. So Enrico Ruotolo, thanks for the super chat. "I get inconsistent voltage peaking as high as 126. I've been using a Variac for my amps. When the voltage passes 120, the copy for the Amprex brown box suggests Variacs are unsafe to use for extended periods. Is this true?"
Why would that be?
I've never had a problem.
I mean, I've used Variacs forever. I don't really think it's an issue. Although the brown box is a cool little thing.
You know, I use it.
But it's fixed, you know.
I got one right there.
But you can for $70, you can buy a cool digital readout Variac now for just, you can see your voltage and just adjust it and you're good. Yes, 126 sounds like shit. So I would even say go a little lower than 120 here in the U.S., like 118-ish, 117-ish. It's just a few volts lower just makes a little difference. When the voltage starts getting high, the amp starts to sounding harsh. Brittle, almost.
Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, you don't have to go really low or anything. Just drop it a tiny bit.
I mean, for me, I rebiased all my amps for 115.
Oh, and then you run it at 115 all the time.
Uh huh.
That's great.
Yep.
That's fine. You can do that.
Keep it good.
Even more inconsistent across Europe. It's like, okay, it's supposed to be 230 volts in most countries, theoretically. Theoretically, I've never found that to be true.
No.
I mean, the UK, right? I mean, theoretically, it's supposed to be 230 volt. They're supposed to have changed.
It's supposed to be 240.
Well, is it?
I heard so.
It was supposed to be changed, but that's not, I mean, like 240, then I hear 236, then I hear, 238, to this, to that. And I've heard even in countries that are 230 saying, yeah, it's more like 236. So it really kind of comes in a problem. I guess we have that variance here too, because some places can be as high as 126 around, 6 volt difference. But when you're setting the amp for Europe, I set all the amps at 240 volts. no matter what country they're in. Because I found that the 230 countries aren't 230, and I'd rather have it run lower than hotter. So,
yeah, that makes sense. Actually, when I had a Furman like hooked up that just had like the voltage on the front, I don't know how dependable those things are, but I would frequently see it getting like above 240. Like at one point, I think I saw it get up to like 250, something like that. Which,
yeah, that's a real, like that's, a see, that starts to get really a problem. But yeah, those aren't always accurate. So,
no, I figured, yeah,
it's always good to
get a multimeter,
run it at the proper voltage using something, brown box or a variac.
Tim Connors, thanks for the super chat. We actually did cover this about miking the speakers on the side where the wires connect. We covered that for Pete. Let's go to the next one. Mr. Woodchuck, what's going on? Thanks for the super chat. Hey, Nolly, big fan. Your products convinced me to pick up a 2x12 Zilla FB cab with a 1V30 and one G. Fat boy cab, okay, and one G12 H75. What is your go-to number one cab these days?
Yeah, I'm such a sucker for the Mesa 412 for high gain stuff. Angled, oversized Mesa 412 with speakers from like 2000 to 2003. I've got a bunch of them. At one point, I had like, I want to say I had 12 Mesa 412s like in our old house. And when I was kind of refining that GGD product, and I sold off a few of them, and I just have good ones now. For metal, I just think they, for high gain, like I was saying, they just, right off the mic, they just work so well. But I do like greenbacks. I think the greenback cab that I have with the 2003 greenbacks is my favorite. Again, because so much of the time I'm doing like heavy music, the greenbacks that tend towards the smoother end of things tend to work pretty well. And I think the Zillas sound great. I actually should mention, I have a Zilla 412 that sounds phenomenal. And I stapled some acoustic paneling inside it. It's had all manner of speakers. And I ended up actually putting back the 2012 Chinese-made vintage 30s that it had in it when I got it in 2012. And having been on this wild tone chase for like a decade, I put those ones back in. I was like, sounds pretty good. I guess I could have just like omitted the whole in between, but I think the Zilla 212 sound phenomenal too. I personally like vintage 30s a lot. I would probably go for two V30s or a V30 with a like a red back. I quite like a red back as well.
Red back's interesting speaker.
Mm.
What are your thoughts on that?
Again, it works well for high gain. It tends to have like quite a peaky frequency at like around 4k that can be a bit problematic, but you take that out and it sounds pretty big and meaty. So if you do want a cab with a couple of different speakers to blend, that works well. But vintage 30 cab, 8 ohm and a 16 ohm greenback cab, and I'm set for most things, I think.
Yeah,
cool. Enrico Ruotolo again. Nolly, what power amp or amp effects return are you using when making IRs?
So I like to use a tube power amp to do it, which like a guitar power amp, which because of the impedance curve colors the IR a lot in a way that you don't want, because it's like you're kind of doubling down on the on that impedance curve that you get from the interaction between like the output transformer and the cab. So you then need to figure out how to remove the voicing of that coloration, like the EQ curve, but that way you keep the dynamics. So like the way that the power amp is reacting to the cab as it's doing its sweeps, which I think gives it an extra level of realism to just using a solid state power amp. But am I saying that, you know, you plug me into an IR that was done with a solid state power amp and I'd be like, oh, what is this? You know, like it's a subtle difference, but having been through, down the rabbit hole, you know, when you're gonna make a product, it makes sense to shoot out all options, and having kind of gone down that route, I had a preference for the sound and feel of the ones made with an actual guitar power amp that you then flatten out after the fact. Okay. What did you do for yours, Dave?
Mine were done with an H&H power amp, an old H&H power amp, which I find quite gutsy. Yeah, but it sounds better than a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very gutsy power amp that was used for years with, guys, people back in the heyday of racks and things, when guys were using wet, dry, wet rigs and things like that. And it sonically is really pretty transparent, but it's got a really just meaty tone. You know, it's not like a, you know, I would never use a Class D amp or anything like that to do this.
So when you say something like meaty, what punchy. Kind of thing are you thinking of? So punchy, like good transient response?
Good transient
response. Low-end transient response, yeah.
Not too dark, not necessarily too bright either. Just a really good power amp. I think it just does a better, it did a really good job when we were doing them. But there's tons of different power amps that could be used and tons of different ways to do it. What did you actually use though?
I've used different ones. Actually, the Greenback ones are the BE100 behind me. I used that as the power section when we did the Greenback for the Vintage 30, the Mesa Boogie ones. I used my, I don't know if you can see it, my block letter 5150. We know that the block letter itself doesn't mean very much, but that's my 5150.
Yeah, yeah. And are you one, setting the presence a certain way, or are you turning them off, or what are you doing with?
Yeah, I kind of settled on just keeping them. You want something recallable, right? I was doing this over a while. I settled on just keeping them at noon. I'm flattening out the EQ response. But I figured that having them doing something.
What are you flattening them out with?
With match EQ.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah. So you can basically subtract. You can figure it out like with and without coloration and then subtract. But you will have the certain aspects of the response of the power amp baked into the IR as well.
Mm-hmm.
And IR isn't dynamic, but it does have length. It does have a time domain. So
yeah.
The way that the power amp is working with the cab does make a difference in that way. So, you know, I feel like with a lot of these things, certain people, especially online, love to say that there's no difference to be heard. And I think it's difficult to hear stuff like that, like things which are not EQ curve, but time related.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a different dimension of the sound. And again, it's not like it's make or break, but I think if you're going to do products, it makes sense to do it in a way that, you know, is as best as it can possibly be. So, yeah, it was not a big difference between having the knobs off or on full or at midway. But I was like, I'm just going to stick them at noon, and that's a decent enough setting.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
We got Michael Nielsen in the house. What's up,
Michael? Hey, Michael.
How you doing, man? And also Ben Coombs. What's up, Ben? Thanks for moderating the show here. Not moderating, you know, the taking care of the chat and everything.
I would be moderating it, kind of.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, that's moderating. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I forgot what the term was that they have on here, but yeah. Zach Wish, what's going on? Dave, thanks for all the killer amps, and Nolly, thanks for the endless inspiration over the years. I use Get Good Drums daily. Nolly, what's your monitoring situation like these days? Love the show. Thanks, man.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. That's super kind of you, and an honor as well. I've been using now for about 3 years my Key 3 monitors. They're a German company, very high-end monitors. They have two designs, but for the longest time they just had one design that they kind of marketed separately to the hi-fi world and the pro audio world. And to me, they're just the most brilliant and engaging sounding monitors I've heard. Everyone that's heard them pretty much has gone and bought them, and quite a lot of big name guys in the metal sphere are using them now. And in rock as well, and they already were pretty well established within the kind of, you know, outside rock and metal. So the cool thing about them is they have speakers, like ports all around them, that they use to cancel out the sound behind the speaker. So usually off a speaker, like the sub frequencies are pretty much, they go everywhere, like, you know, they radiate out in equal power in all directions. So when you've got a studio, that means that the back wall and the back corners become like these huge problem areas for the low end response of your room. These are like cardioid, so like a microphone response, you know, basically have a null at the back all the way down to like 50 hertz or something like that. And even then it's just starting to open up into being a bit more kind of omni. So the result is, when you're in a small room like here, this is my mixed room in my house, it's like the room is just taken almost completely out of the equation. So even if the speakers themselves only sounded 75% as good as like a set of high-end ATCs or something, in this room they would win. And then you add on top of the fact that they're actually really great sounding speakers. And
what's the brand?
They're Kii. So K-I-I.
K-I-I.
Okay. K-I-I. You should check them out. And I'll tell you, like, when I was shopping for high-end monitors, I didn't want to like these ones. I kind of thought they looked a bit ugly. And I really wanted, I was like, I'm going to spend some big money. I'm going to put my money on like one of the classic tried and tested designs, the ATCs, PMCs, like, you know, the really high end kind of British voiced analog speakers. And I was just about to audition a whole load of them in this room when I saw a pair of these come up used, like B stock. And I was like, all right, fine. It's a pretty good price. I could sell them on for the same thing. So I bought them, I set them up and I listened. I was like, okay, cancel the audition. Like, because I mean, it's a really mind-bending thing anyway, auditioning speakers. It takes so long to kind of change them around, and then you have to spend a bit of time with them, and you can really lose yourself in it. But there's an engaging quality to these speakers that I've not heard in anything else. Like, it's so three-dimensional. And even non-musicians, you know, like friends of the family and people that come and sit here, you put on some music for them, you've got sub lows down to like 30 hertz coming at you from the same place as everything else, and it's all time aligned. Mm-hmm. And it just sounds so crystal clear. Actually, someone who's using them now is Stephen Slate, if you know Stephen.
Yeah.
He recently got some, because he's doing this product, the virtual headphones, where he's going into high-end rooms, like the best rooms in the world, most flat with the best speakers, and profiling them. And he recently got some Kii's, and he posted like, this is, you know, the best thing I've ever heard. So that to me speaks quite highly. I like Stephen a lot. And also the fact that he's had that experience. I'm saying all this like I'm some representative of the company or I get a commission. I don't. I wish I did.
But, you're not getting paid for this?
I mean, I wish. Can we sort something out?
That's funny. Steve Malt, thanks for the super chat. Nolly, Evergrey is one of my my favorite bands of all time. I would love to hear any info or stories about working with them, guitars, bass, drums, etc.
Yeah, okay. This is really cool. This is current. Evergrey is a Swedish band from Gothenburg. I literally, well, maybe it's 2 weeks ago now, we got the final masters back from the record that we did. They've been around for a few decades, and I don't really know why they reached out to me to work with me, but it turned into a really great collaboration. And I don't work with that many bands in a year, like one or two, sometimes a bit more. It's just starting to do a bit more. But I like to get really involved with the bands that I do work with, you know, work with people that I really like and that I care about, like helping in their creative vision. So I went out to Gothenburg, and they've got a rehearsal space, which is, it used to be the control room of a major studio in Gothenburg that got like decommissioned and being used for all sorts of different stuff. So it's not got anything in it, and it's a very dead space. And they had their drums set up there. They had all their, you know, the rehearsing in there. And they wanted to use that to record in. So I went out there and I helped them refine like the drum mic positions, talking about tuning. We found that there's like an adjacent room that has an amazing, like really out of control reverb, like a chamber. So we've got some like room mics out there for the drums. We actually captured some profiles of their amps. Like they've got some cool Bogners, and well, Henrik, one of the guitarists, has like a huge collection of amps. He brought a bunch of stuff out. And we captured some profiles. I took some IRs of their cabs. The bassist was there as well, and you know, kind of showed his rig. We kind of did a few test recordings there and then. It was only 2 or 3 days, and then I flew back to England. They recorded their record and then sent everything to me to mix. And what I think is really cool is they're a very like authentic bunch of guys. Like they're really just really good people, and their music's and the lyrics and everything have like a lot of emotional resonance and wisdom in them. And I feel like for the last few records they've sounded really good, but they haven't necessarily sounded like them, if that makes sense. Like it's quite a polished up version, quite kind of pop production. And this record, I think it sounds like the best version of what you'd get if you went and saw them live. Like it's relatively unedited because they handled all of that. It still sounds really tight and everything, but it's like their amps, their drums, their everything. And I love that. I love when there's like this kind of authenticity to the whole production that kind of leads back to the artist. Cause I think it matters with like the artist has used their gear on a record and they can listen to the song and be like, oh yeah, I remembered tuning my snare drum a bit higher for that song. And it sounds like it's not the same sample as on like the last three tracks or whatever. So that's been a really fruitful production, and I'm very much looking forward to what people think when they hear it.
Awesome. Super cool. Look forward to hearing it. Let's see. The other John Brown.
He's here.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
right. Already enjoying this so much. So here's some money. Cheers. Awesome. Oh. Thanks, man.
Yeah, everyone should go watch his videos if they're at all interested about the V30 hunt. He's continually releasing new ones.
Deep dive.
Yeah.
Very cool. Scott Robertson. I have the Behringer Knuckles Polymath pickups in three very different guitars, and they are fabulous. Open, dynamic, and articulate. Thank you, Nolly. Yeah, let's talk about those.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, that's my pleasure, Scott. I'm really happy that you like them so much, and that you've got three sets of them. That's awesome. Yeah, so Behringer, so Tim from Behringer, who you have had on the show, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
He was like the first person in the industry to ever, he was just like one of the first contacts I had in the industry, and he just really kind of mentored me and had faith in me. He asked me very early on, he was redoing his website, and he knew a bit of my playing and invited me down to like do all the clips for the site, which meant I got to try all of the range as it was at that point, you know, all of them, all the P90s, all the single coils, Tele and Strat, all the humbuckers. And, you know, I just spent a lot of time down there with Tim learning about pickups. I've never wound my own pickup, but, you know, I've been through the development of quite a few. And when Misha from Periphery did like his first signature pickup, the Juggernaut, he wanted me there like just as someone to bounce ideas off in like a second pair of ears.
That was a cool pickup too. That sounded
great. It was, yeah.
It did sound very good. I actually had it in a Jackson guitar.
Oh, do you? Is it Misha's guitar or is it another one?
No, it was it was just a solo. Well, no, it was a Jackson soloist, yeah. Silver Sparkle. But it came with his signature pickup in it, and right. For whatever reason, yeah, and it sounded great. So
yeah, it's a really big sounding pickup, that one.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then I ended up in the room for the Ragnarok, which is like the next pickup they did, which is like a pretty different vibe, like very very high output pickup. And then Rabia had me around as well when he did the Silo, which was very cool. And then I got into contact through an owner of a studio called Middle Farm Studios, which is a studio I've used a lot. The owner, Pete, you know, a friend, and has always been really good to me. Just down the road from them is Manson Guitar Works. That's the company that builds guitars for like Matt Bellamy from Muse, that have like all the crazy stuff built into them, the fuzz factories and the chaos pads and stuff. It's like a really small workshop. And they wanted to develop a guitar outside the kind of Tele shape. Their company was kind of built out of the kind of heritage of Hugh Manson, who's like a master UK builder. He had all sorts of shapes. He's been building from the 80s and 90s, like super high-end guitars and basses. And they've kind of fallen mostly into doing the kind of Muse guitars or that shape, the kind of Tele style guitars that plays. And they wanted to do something for a different audience, and Pete connected me to them, and we ended up designing a guitar that came out a couple of years ago now. So it's not really a signature guitar, but it's kind of like designed with. It's called the Oryx. That's what we ended up on. And this is kind of like, to me, the ultimate sounding guitar. Like we went from the ground up to, you know, trying to design the best sounding guitar we could, which included trying all the different components. And we can get into, I'm sure, Dave, you've got lots of opinions on what makes a great sounding guitar, but you know, like the bridge is a huge one, all the electronics, of course.
I love how that looks.
Lots of, oh, cool. Yeah, this is a beautiful one. And this is one that we did for me with a roasted maple neck. Mm. I've got a really nice one over there. I'll show you as well in a sec. But so I thought what would be cool. They actually have a guy in-house winding pickups who's really good. And, you know, it would have made sense to use his pickups apart from the fact that I had such a long-standing relationship with Tim. Mm-hmm. So, and obviously, you know, the Behringer name is got a lot of prestige in the guitar world. So I wanted to work with Tim to voice a pickup for the guitar. And I didn't really think that I deserved a signature pickup because I'm not out there playing guitar. I don't have any solo albums or even, you know, any albums to my name at all. But Tim was really up for it. And he was like, well, no, we need to release this as a signature pickup. I'm sure people will want to buy it. And that's very, you know, cool of him to do that. And it has actually gone on, I think, to be their best selling humbucker in the range, which is cool. Bananas to me. And we've had just such great feedback on it. Like even, I don't know if I'm supposed to name them, like a couple of people that with other companies or that work for magazines where they're supposed to be unbiased have like DM'd us being like, these are literally like the best humbuckers I've ever tried kind of thing, which is awesome. And it's really a testament to Tim's vision. The idea was to have like a Goldilocks pickup that's kind of right in the middle of the output zone. So, you know, something like a Duncan Custom or like a, something like that, where it's, you know, it's about 14K wound with 43 gauge wire. So like in between kind of old school and modern school wires. We ended up using unoriented Almeco 5, which I think is the first in like a major production pickup to use unoriented. So all the magnet types, like the Almecos up to 4 are unoriented, which means like all the magnetic particles, let's call them for now, within the magnet are kind of, because of the process, they're not all aligned in one direction. So that's 1 to 4, and then 5 is typically done in a different way, which means that everything's aligned. It makes a stronger magnet, and it's kind of the reason why all those lower numbers have like that more mid-forward sound, where Almeco 5 suddenly goes quite bright and scooped. These are Almeco 5, but made with that same process that's used for the production of like Almeco 2 through to 4. I think even back in like the early days of Gibson, you could, a lot of Almeco 5 would have been unoriented. And the cool thing is it has that really mid-forward sound, but it's a lot tighter than 4 or 2 or anything like that. So it was interesting because we were building the whole thing around the regular Almeco 5, and then Tim was sending up boxes of magnets, and he was like, you got to try this one. And I really didn't want to try it because I knew it was going to be lower output. And I was like, I feel like we need to make this a grunty pickup for the heavy stuff. Mm-hmm. And I put it in, and it was just like, it was incredible. Like literally one of those moments, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, where you just hit it and you just know, like, I think even I like picked up the guitar from having worked on it and just like thumbed the string, and you could just feel the response. I was just like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then I started playing, and it really, because all the mids had come forwards all of a sudden. So even though the output wasn't super high, it just pushed the amp in such a cool way that was really tight and smooth.
Yeah.
So it's about 14K wind. We worked a lot on the offset. And with that magnet in, it's also only partially potted as well. So it's a little bit more kind of touch sensitive and harmonic-y than a regular pickup. So
that's interesting. Partially potted. I've not heard of that yet.
Well, like with a pickup, with a humbucker, you pot like the individual coils, which are made separately. And then typically once the pickup's constructed, they then pot the whole thing again with a cover on or off. So the whole thing is then kind of set in wax. So I actually don't know off the top of my head exactly. And I'm sure there's more to it than just like a binary yes or no thing, but I'm pretty sure that the coils are potted, but then the whole thing isn't. But then I think maybe the way that he's potting it is allowing for a little bit more kind of harmonics and more of the unpotted sound to come through. So yeah, they've gone on to be really, really successful and loved, which is awesome. I still love them. And we're actually in the process, quite close to the end now, of taking the same concept of the wind and the magnet and doing a 42 gauge, so like a PAF style pickup. With the same coil offset similar coil offset and a couple of other ideas that we're toying with. Because I think that, again, you think you're going lower output when you go down in gauge, but actually you tend to get a bit more headroom. It's actually a bit of a louder pickup. And you've got less low end and more attack. It's actually, if anything, like a more aggressive sounding pickup, even though this one's hotter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Let me, one sec, I'm just going to grab the other Oryx to show you that I've got. That's very cool, because I liked that one so much, but I would still like to play a Strat style guitar from time to time. So I asked them if they could make me.
That looks cool Oryx. Too.
It's so cool. It's got like a crazy flame maple neck on it.
Yeah,
I love it. It's a modern guitar, but it still has little touches of the past, and it's appealing looking. It's just visually a very, the architecture of it is appealing.
I'm really glad you think so. Yeah, we worked a lot on it. And I mean, the minutiae, like I had them moving the bridge pickup like a millimeter at a time on the prototype backwards and forwards, because again, that's a bit like the mic around the cone. You'll know this, like you grab an SG and a Les Paul and look at where the bridge pickups are.
Yeah.
Like the SG, the pickup's way closer to the bridge in general. I mean, there's variations. And that's accountable for so much of the difference in sound. And then you grab like a V or an Explorer and it's gone the other way, and they always sound more bass heavy and darker and kind of quacky. And it's like, if you actually do get a Les Paul, as you do sometimes, where the bridge pickup's closer to the bridge, it sounds like an SG. You know what I mean? Or an SG the other way doesn't really sound like an SG anymore. And yeah, that little position there changes everything about the voice of the bridge pickup.
I remember when Eddie Van Halen was doing the new guitars with Fender for his new guitars, the prototype guitars, there was one of them, They had a big square route because he would screw him into the wood. And their big square route where the bridge pickup was, where he was experimenting with exactly where he wanted to place it from the bridge. And it would just, I mean, like literally it looked like it was chiseled out by him. But you know, this big gaping hole, but you know, he found his little sweet spot, you know, that he really liked how it attacked and everything.
And I mean, that's a rabbit hole too, because that distance is going to change depending on the string gauge once you intonate it.
Correct.
As well. And then like you change the scale length of a guitar. And if you think about it, you've actually changed like the size of the pickup relative to the strings. Like, you know what I mean? Like if you scale up a short scale guitar so that it's the same length, now you've made the pickups bigger. So like, it's like you change any aspect of the guitar and it really changes those things. And
you can go down this rabbit everything, literally. Yeah. What cables do you like? What this, what that, what direction the cable's in? Oh my God. You can go down this path.
Yeah.
The vast majority of people don't really hear it, I've noticed. If you're really hyper analyzing, and in the end, doesn't matter. Now that's the question. I mean, some of it matters, of course, but in the end, like if you take, you know, your same, say, guitar rig and whatever you have, and you go into a different, and you're actually playing through cabinets, and you go into a different room, those rooms sound so much different from each other.
Yeah.
Then that throws like the whole thing out the window, you know, like, yeah, in, you know, in some respects.
Yeah. Know, I do think there's certain things where you'll know this, everyone that plays an instrument will know this. And I think if you're a product designer, it's really important to kind of keep it in mind where just for some reason, you just get an intuitive, like, yes, like that just, that just feels awesome.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, really important thing to latch onto, you know?
I feel that way about pedals, right? So a pedal. So the new pedal, you plug it in, and if it immediately goes, ooh, I like that. Like immediately.
Yeah.
I consider that a great pedal, you know? If you're like, oh, yeah, it does that pretty well. Okay, kind of. Let me tweak it a little. No, it's already a bad pedal.
Yeah.
There's a ooh factor, I sort of call it. You know, it's like it hits you right away. You know right away that you're going to love this.
Yeah, and it can be problematic because when you're in that mode, when your antennae are set that way of like just experience, you're so open to bias at the same time. You know what I mean? Like it's so easy. Like if you're shooting out cabs and they're next to each other, just the fact that one's slightly more on one side than the other is going to affect your perception of it, stuff like that, you know? But then if you go the other way where it's just cold rationality, like just, I'm only going to listen to the recordings, like recorded exactly the same way every time. That's a really clinical way of looking at it. It can be good for debunking certain things, but it's like really negating the experiential part. And it's like,
Yeah.
I feel like the good products, like you focus on the things that matter on both sides. Like you don't have to go to the point where it's something which is completely inaudible, but you really latch on to the things which, you know, as an experience as a musician or as, you know, the person playing the instrument can feel, then I think that goes a long way.
Well, also there's bias too. So if say you're A-ing two amps for someone, one, you have to do an amp switcher first off in real time. Two, you have to have them not looking at what they're hearing. Because if they're, I swear to God, if they're looking at, say you're A being a Marshall and a Friedman together, right? And they're looking at it and they know which is which, they will pick their preferred, so-called preferred brand. If you blindfold them, they can't see what's going on. It changes radically, generally, what they like. Or the Friedman doesn't sound the same as the Marshall. Oh, yeah? Okay, let's try this. Dial it in so it's as close as humanly possible. And then they're switching back and forth. And if they guess it wrong like five different times, then I'm like, well, it sounds the same.
You're right. It's really frustrating, but it is ultimately like a feature rather than a bug of us as creatures. Yeah. Like, you know, we just can't help but take in information through all of our senses to, because, mm-hmm. you know, in the wild, we couldn't be like judging every single thing on this purely yeah. rational, like, you know, yeah. we need to be able to react and as part of our intelligence as creatures. But yeah, it can set you up for horrendous bias.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes you go with it, you know, especially if you're working as a producer, it's like, I care that the instrumentalist loves what he's doing right now. So if that means using the head, which sounds identical to the other one and is just way more of a hassle, but that's the one that he wants, let's use that one because he's going to have a good time and that matters in the creation mm-hmm. of anything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then again, as a product designer, you kind of have to have this other hat on. Does yeah. this really matter? And I'm sure it's very frustrating for you, Dave. I mean, I've hung out on the forums a lot that you always see like, oh yeah, and no, like Friedman's amps are like kind of more compressed, darker, like kind of tamed, like you took a Marshall and cut the balls off it or some like ridiculous thing like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, you just know, like if you can read a schematic and look at what's going on, it's like, what's Dave done exactly to do what you're saying?
Yeah. You know, I find that funny. I mean, and then I do make it brighter and different for the people,
and then they say, and then right.
what happens is they go, oh, I don't know, it seems really bright now, and I don't know if I, you know, I like that as much. I like the 2000 and whatever 14 year of that better. Well, that's the one you said that was too dark and compressed.
It's crazy. And you know,
I like going,
the adjective okay. changes depending on what they're talking about. Right? Like if it's the one that they like, it's airy or it's thick. And if it's the one they don't like, it's harsh or it's muddy. You know what I mean? It's the same frequencies. They're just, well, then also,
what I always say is, what is your idea of a great, you know, what the Marshalls say? What is your idea of a great Marshall? What is it that you are comparing it to? Because if you say a JCM 800, I consider that a Marshall. I consider that a sound, but I don't consider that a great Marshall. Mm-hmm. I am more geared towards an old Plexi Marshall, you know, that is cranked. And that has compression. And that has all this stuff that I tried to build into a preamp-based amp.
Yeah.
That feel and the gushy feeling and all that of that Plexi cranked on 10, maybe with a Variac or something. I tried to build that into the amps. So that was what my idea was, the ideal sounds. And if you AB that sound to what I did, you were like, yeah, you can get that sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
I think you've done a great job with it, man. Like I've got, it's a metal face, like a 70-75, I think, mm-hmm. Super lead. But I've gone through it. I've changed a couple of bits. I've actually put switches so you can have like the fat cap on or mm-hmm. off. You can have yeah. the bright on or off. And like, sure. you know, it's got a few holes in it and stuff. It's not the most beautiful amp. It's got a 69 Dagnall output transformer.
Oh, great. Well. Great. There you go.
So like, that's one of my reference points. And, you know, I've got JCM 800, JMP.
Yeah.
And A, I don't see anything apart from the fact that you've obviously got like a bit of depth coming from the negative feedback, which I think mm-hmm. is a good thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really like not having that little bit of sag in the low end that you get from, you know, an old, like a JCM 800, especially, like, I feel like really needs that.
Yeah.
And then B, like if you look at the schematic, and I don't know how completely accurate they are, and you know a little bit about amp mods, it's like, Dave, you've basically given people most of like the classic mods that people did to Marshalls mm-hmm. just on the switches, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, and if you know what those switches do, it's like, oh my God, I've got like the convertible
yeah
modded Marshall at my fingertips. So
exactly.
And it feels really good. That thing I was talking about you plug in and you just kind of just thumb the string and you get the response. And it's like, okay, the person that voiced and designed this kind of has figured out how to make it feel right as a player. And I guess the proof
that was really in is
how many
thing.
Players use it.
So. That was an important thing.
Yep. And that makes a big difference, definitely, because not all amps have that. So let's dive into the questions because we are behind. Valentin Zwick Nolly, longtime user of your drum products. Now that you have the bass library, any plans on a wider product portfolio? Bass IRs would make sense now. Keep quality stuff coming, man.
Thank you very much, Valentin. I do, of course, recognize your name. We've had many exchanges on the GTD forum. Well, thank you very much also for all the support for the company. Bass IRs, I mean, yeah, they are, we will do them at some point. The truth is, I don't know that I have as specific preferences with bass IRs. Like there's a few, like bass cabs in general, like there's a few cabs and mics that do what I like. And I haven't yet got inspired or really gone down the rabbit hole of what I could do to create a product that really offers like lots of cool options to people, because all the products we do come out of like a real desire, like an inspiration to do them. Like I did the Mesa Boogie one because I was on this personal tone hunt and it was like, may as well like kind of put together the best ones of these and share them with the world. And apart from making a bit of money, it's also like, I feel like it kind of reduces collective frustration a little bit. Everyone can get good guitar tones, you know?
Right.
And I just haven't felt that with bass yet, but I'd like to. And I certainly don't have a collection of bass cabs like I do of guitar cabs. So it's going to be a different project of probably, you know, begging, borrowing and, well, not stealing, but bass cabs and going to different studios and trying them out and kind of figuring out what the boundaries of that product are. But yeah, it will happen at some point. Just no idea when yet.
Okay. Awesome. Mr. Anderson. Hey guys, after having every pre-post roll of Celestion, I've settled to a quad of original G1265s and a 70s 4x12B. It just sounds insane. The problem with these is that there are a gazillion versions.
Yeah, it's kind of what we were talking about before. There's like so many different versions of just between the omages and the bass and lead speak, like cones, there's a lot of variation, but then there's all these different kinds of dust cap designs. There's the ones that are vented on the back versus the other ones. I think the ones that people like the most tend to be the bass cone original, like vented speakers with just make sure it doesn't have like an aluminium dust cap on those, because those tend to sound crazy bright.
Okay, cool. So tell me, how did you meet Misha and get involved with Periphery?
Yeah, so I met Misha, I don't even know, it must be like 16 years ago or something now. At that point, you know, the music we were into, which was bands like Meshuggah, particularly one band called Sixth, that were very much a cult band from the UK. They broke up around 2008, I think, and then they've recently reformed. I actually got to mix their kind of comeback record. But actually Sixth was the band that was the point of contact with Misha. At that point, Misha just had like his MSN handle freely available on MySpace to, you know, put a date on when this was. And I'd just joined a band called Red Sea's Fire. We were just starting out, and the other guitarist who'd set up the band had said that he was really into like Periphery. And all the other bands he'd listed I knew, but I didn't know Periphery, or I forget if he put Bulb or Periphery on there. And then once I joined the band, he was like, oh, I've actually been talking with Misha, and he's flying through the UK, because he would quite frequently fly from DC to Mauritius, where his parents were at the time. And that flight would often have a stopover in the UK. And because it's such a small scene, it was like, wow, someone else likes the same music as me, you know, from his end. And he was like, well, I'm going to be in London, you know, in a couple of months, got like a, you know, night stopover, come by the hotel room, we can just like hang out kind of thing. And he thought, I guess, that we lived in London. I lived about 2 hours away. But first of all, I drove 2 hours the wrong direction to the other guitarist's house. I promise there's a point to this whole divergence. We drove to London, got to Misha's like at night, like, I don't know, 10 p.m. or something. And we had like, it was cool. Like he had a guitar there, we had guitars there. We were like jamming riffs that we knew. It was like, you know, one of those meetings where you get to meet someone that's into something really niche that you are as well. It was cool. But it got to like 2 or 3 a.m. And we'd been working on the assumption that we were going to get to like crash at his hotel room, because we obviously just spent like 6 hours on the road at that point. And didn't really feel like repeating that. And then it got to like that time, and he's just like, cool, well, it's been really nice meeting you. I'm going to go to bed now. I'll see you around. And we were like, oh, he thinks we live really locally. So we had to like, from 3 a.m., we did like this monstrous drive we weren't planning on doing, like all the way past my house to be able to get my car, to be able to return back to home. I don't know if it was just guilt on his part or what, but he ended up kind of continuing to have a really good kind of relationship with me and the guys in the band. They needed a bassist on the first major tour they did. I'd been studying guitar. My guitar has always been my main instrument. But their bassist was getting married and going away on honeymoon. He was going to miss the first half of the first big tour that Proofread ever did. And they were like, well, we don't have any money, but if you want to come out and go on tour, you can on bass, which I had no experience doing. But I knew how to play the songs on guitar. So I said, yeah, I thought it would be a cool experience. I flew out, did a summer tour, like going through like, you know, all the southern states. That was quite an experience in a van, you know, like the real rough end of US touring. And I think from there, it was just like, you know, my relationship with the band was really sealed. They got me out to, they called me a co-producer on their second record, which was the first time they were working in someone else's studio. The first record was done all kind of in-house. And I think they wanted someone that got the sound to be there as a kind of representative of what they were trying to do. So they didn't end up with like a kind of just a rock sound or something, which wasn't really what they were trying to do. Mm-hmm. I was very inexperienced. And like I said, I definitely didn't deserve to have a co-production credit, but I guess just by being in the room, the same bassist that had not been there for that first tour, Tom, ended up leaving the band just before that record. And I ended up playing the bass on the record because there was no one to play the bass. It turned out I was pretty good at it. For whatever reason, my technique on guitar was like quite consistent, and that translated really well to bass. And then, yeah, pretty soon after that, there was a point where it looked like I might have joined on guitar because they needed a guitarist. There's quite a few lineup changes in the early days. But then they locked in Mark, who's Mark Holcomb. Might come across Mark. He's a fantastic guitarist. One of, you know, became like a real foil to Misha as a songwriter in the band, and absolutely was the right call as the guitarist in the band. But the bass position remained unfilled, and I had that decision of like, do I pursue with my small time band in the UK, or do I just like hop straight into touring with Dream Theater on a, you know, on a bus with Periphery as a bassist? And I made that decision, and I'm really pleased I did. You know, I think a lot of people would be like, well, you were, you know, we really cared about guitar doing a degree and cared about shredding and instrumental guitar and all that kind of stuff. And I end up as a bassist, but I kind of had this unique position of being the only one of that instrument in the band. Whereas if I joined as a guitarist, I'd have been, you know, as the other guys really did, kind of have to find their own space alongside Misha, right, who's just, you know, is just such a visible figure in the band, and rightfully so. And that pretty quickly became like a search for like, okay, what kind of bass sounds good for metal. I didn't know what I was doing. I liked Warwick basses. We would use like a Fender Jazz a bit when the tuning wasn't too low, and I liked those sounds. And I'd always had in mind that that original bassist Tom had a Dingwall bass. He was like more of like an R&B, well, I don't know if he was an R&B bassist, but those basses were seen more as like for the kind of really high-end bass market. They weren't seen as metal basses that you'd thrash on tour. But it just coincided that they'd recently released their Chinese-made arranged Combustion series, which, if you've met Sheldon Dingwall, Canadian company, he's incredibly scrupulous, like really cares about everything being done to the highest standard. So he'd found like the best factory he possibly could, been through lots of revisions in making sure that the instrument was like really rock solid. And it just suited my needs perfectly. It was like basically like a jazz bass formula, but it had this fan fret system so that the, you know, the low string was a 37-inch scale, so 3 inches longer than a regular bass, which for the low tunings is a godsend. You don't need to use like a cable for that low string, so it still sounds really bright and kind of like a piano-like kind of low end. And they just come out with this kind of cheaper, very tourable basses. So, you know, I met him at the London bass show, tried run the basses, met my future wife the same day. Also met with Doug from Dark Glass Electronics, who then went on to set up Neural DSP. And it was probably one of the most fruitful days of my life, I guess. I kind of ended up starting that relationship with Dingwall that resulted after a couple of years of doing a signature instrument, which is the one that you highlighted before, which has been going strong for 10 years now, I think. I think it's literally been 10 years this year. And it just seems to not stop selling, I guess, because there wasn't really like a defined bass for that genre that went on to be really popular, of like modern progressive metal, and that handled the low tunings really well, and the price points right, and they kind of look cool. And, you know, everyone from John Taylor from Duran Duran, who's just got a signature model now with Dingwall, he was playing one of my basses for a while. Just like crazy to see like all these non-metal guys playing my bass. It doesn't have my name on the front or anything. It's just like a funky looking bass. And yeah, just that's seems cool. To yeah, be an instrument that just kind of keeps on going and going.
Very cool.
It was a very long story that more than answered your question. I hope that's
that was great. We've got Christian Daniel. Dave, what cabinet and speaker is the Mike Nomo based off of? Can we look forward to a Dirty Shirley IRX?
The it's an analog cab sim, the Mike Nomo, so it's not exactly anything. It's I don't know, you could kind of, it was compared to a V30 cab actually. But I don't think it necessarily, it sounds like a Celestion loaded cabinet. How's that? It's kind of in between things.
And IRX Dirty Shirley?
You will see. Mm-hmm. There's more stuff
coming. Can you remind me what the IRX is, Dave?
That's a tube preamp pedal with IRs built in and digital power amp simulation in it. Like
that's what I was thinking it was. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Works really well. Maybe I should talk to you about some new IRs in the future.
I'd love to, man. I'd love
to. Or something specific for...
I mean, I'll have to get you the IR products that we've done. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, and especially the Greenback one. You know, I've learned so much from hearing.
Yeah, I mean, I can load anything. I can load anything in that IRX, so it auto converts. So
great. Yeah. After this call, I'll hook
2048 samples.
Right, nice and long.
Is the max. So anything cool. That's over that gets truncated down. And
sure, but that's 2 seconds of reverb, basically. At that point.
Yeah, it's plenty long. It's long enough.
Yeah, so the Greenback product that we did at my local studio, which is Peter Gabriel's Real World Studio. Mm-hmm. It's like the studio with the biggest SSL in the world. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, playground. I've seen pictures of that place.
It's incredible. It's like 25 minutes from here.
Awesome.
So we did the IRs in the adjoining room, which is like a converted triple height, like old granary barn, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there's a room mic in that pack, which sounds phenomenal. It's really like, it's very different than having like an IR that you made with like a full range speaker that you're then feeding the signal from like a 57 mic into. That's a really different thing than an IR of the actual cab in the room.
Yeah.
Picked up by a room mic. And then, they sound really engaging, especially on a good pair of monitors. It's suddenly like, is there someone playing like in the room just on behind the speakers? It really has that quality. So
Wow. Very cool. We've got a question from Luke Kramer. Thanks for the super chat. Hey Nolly, what's your process start to finish for creating drum libraries? How do hits on each drum get turned into a plugin?
Yeah. I guess there's three parts to it. There's the capturing of the sounds. There's the coding of those sounds, so like kind of making that something that can be played back using MIDI. And then there's like the graphics and implementation and stuff like that. So my part is really the first part. So I go out and capture the sounds, which starts months before with me having, you know, sleepless nights thinking about what drums and cymbals I need to include and how they're going to be tuned and how they're going to be mic'd and which studio it needs to be done at. Like really a lot of love and attention is put into like figuring out, like falling in love really with the premise of the library. And then, you know, the execution of it, we'll set up a kit like it's a real kit. I know not many, but I think some of the older school, like the Roland drum machine things, they do stuff like they record every kit piece individually in the middle of the overhead. So that, you know, it's kind of can be panned any way the user wants, but we want everything set up. So there's, to some degree, you know, sympathetic resonance between stuff and everything's kind of stereo panned as it should be. And that it kind of relates to a real drum recording as well, you know, kind of so that if you're familiar with how things sound when you record drums really well, it should be kind of what you're hearing when you hear the drum library. And then like how you capture the hits. I mean, that's something which we have had to experiment with a huge amount, like how many volume, like intensity levels do you do? How many of each of those you always capture what are called round robins, like where you capture multiple attempts at hitting at the same intensity and they're invariably going to be slightly different. And then when you're programming, even if you program the same intensity, it kind of cycles through those. So it doesn't just sound like a machine gun. Mm-hmm. And there's like a trade-off. You're always thinking about CPU usage and hard drive as well. Like you don't just necessarily go to max. There's going to be a, you know, a point where it doesn't really help anymore, or you're spending a lot of time sampling stuff in the middle of the range where people generally don't program in rock and metal. They tend to either program really hard or really soft. So there's like a lot of planning, and you know, I've got my spreadsheets pretty nailed at this point, so that you make sure you capture everything you need. It takes a long time. We, one of our ranges at the moment are called One Kit Wonders, which I really love doing because there's no options. It's just like, I'm imagining that I'm going to go and record a single with a band, and it's going to be pop punk, let's say. It's like, okay, what would be the archetypal pop punk setup? How would we set it up? How would we tune it? Get it all sound checked, sounding like the best pop punk kit you've ever recorded. And then you don't have to think about moving anything, changing anything. You just sample it exactly as it is with no options. Because obviously once you start, you know, doing libraries with more snare drums and kicks and toms, everything needs to be moved around. And arguably the resonance from one drum might not correspond to what you're hearing if you've loaded things up differently than it was sampled. Really minor differences, but I really like the One Kit Wonder format. And you know, even those, that takes like 3 or 4 days to do one setup of cymbals, one kick, one set of toms and one snare. Cymbals take 6 or 7 times longer than shells do. Like a pair of hi-hats sampled really deeply can take a whole day to do. A tom takes about 10 minutes. you know, we tend to start with cymbals because otherwise it's just crushing. You do all these shells, and then suddenly you're like, oh, there's not that much left, but it's actually like 90% of the work still ahead of you.
Right. That makes sense.
And then it gets handed off to our coding team, who are really experienced and brilliant guys, and they know how to, they go through editing the samples, which means people manually listening for background noises. Actually, our very first library, you could hear like a siren from a car going past, and you know, right in the tail of something, or the drummer kind of saying like, okay, or something, because at that point we hadn't quite figured out our sign language, so that everything's done really silently. So there's people that, you know, manually check for all that, cut everything perfectly, denoise when necessary. And they do a brilliant job. And that's probably the longest part of the process because it needs to be checked by a human being. You know, they're listening back to all of those hours that we were sampled in excruciating detail to make sure that there's not something off with the hits, and sorting them based on their intensity. And then that gets coded into an instrument that plays back, which, you know, you need to think about stuff like what happens when you hit, when someone plays back a ride bell after a ride tip hit on the ride, does it cancel out the previous one? Is that what a ride cymbal does? No. But should it say, you know what I mean? That stuff's called scripting, where you kind of decide on the behavior of something when it's being played back. So, you know, like a tom, on some libraries you hear they have the full sustain of the tom from the previous hit ringing out over the next tom. Mm-hmm. And the weird thing is when you hit a tom, it always has a bit of a dive in pitch. So you get like this weird chord for a second as the new tom gets hit. Anyway, I'm blathering, but there's just a lot to be thought
about. Yeah, and then you get, then you have to, and then you've got the graphics after that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a big process. And I, we have stuff that we recorded years ago that's not yet out, partly because of just, there's a pipeline of stuff and there's a marketing plan and everything. But yeah, it's a long process.
That's awesome. It's great to get some insight into it. Roger Dat, what's up, man? Shaloha, fellas. anyone tried Barefaced Audio's backported cabs? I've got a pair of their 1x12s with Alnico Cream 90s. They sound huge and very versatile. I have not. I've not tried.
I think I looked at them before, but I don't think I. I think I. If it's the one I'm thinking it is. No, I haven't tried.
They have a weird shape to them.
Good question. That's what the internet's for, right?
Uh-huh. I'll cue all of us Googling at the same time.
Barefaced Audio. Yeah.
Oh, they're in England. I didn't actually realize.
Oh, yes. This is what I was thinking of.
It's not what I was thinking of.
This is the one I was thinking of. And I've heard it sounds good. I've never actually experienced. I tried it myself, but
what do you think of those Alnico Creams?
I think that's a good sounding speaker. It's funny. I know some people that do metal that like them.
Yeah, Razor.
I've never actually sat in a room though. I've heard other people use them, but I've never actually personally sat in a room and listened to them and go, that's good. I kind of like, I kind of get in this. I like greenbacks and vintage 30s thing, and that's kind of stuck with me forever. But sometimes I have to use different speakers in different style products, like in our combo amps that we make, our 50 watt or over, well, 50 watt combo amps. I use a Redback now. Because I did use a Creamback M in them, and people would blow them up.
Those are pretty notoriously fallible speakers as well, aren't they?
The Creamback M tends to blow up. I mean, I've had issues with it. I don't know what it is about that one speaker. And so I was like, well, we can't have them blowing up. It only blows up in open back combo kind of things. Like in our teal cabinets that are ported, I've never seen one blow up.
Must be something about the free air at high SPL or something.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, maybe the cone excursion is too much. I don't know. Interesting. So I put the Redbacks in those. And actually, I actually prefer the Redback in the combos because it's sort of like the Redback seems really solid in the mid-range, a very solid sounding speaker with good low end. And in an open back combo, which is sort of scoop sounding, you know, it really sort of helps fill it out a bit in the middle. And it is a little rolled on the top end too. So it's kind of nice in the combo. Works really well.
I think that's what's nice about the Redback. I think it's actually a really well-designed speaker because it's the high wattage thing. And I think they're very much going for people with 112s and stuff like that still have their 100 watt heads.
Yeah.
But the voicing really suits the application of the kind of cabs they go in. So I think that's why I have a lot of respect for that speaker.
Yeah, it's good. I also like Creamback H speakers.
Yeah,
I think those are cool. They sound great in a 412. I remember when I first did that, and when I first heard that, I was at George Metropolis's shop, and he had one cab loaded with the H's, and I would just played an amp through it, and I'm like, I love this cab. What the hell is in this cab? This sounds great, you know. And he had those in him, and I'm like, those are cool too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to claim too much, but back in the day, like right as they got released, I was with Zilla, Paul from Zilla. We did like a load of clips of his cabs, and we were putting combinations of speakers in the cabs to record them.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, our favorite two speakers were the Vintage 30 and one of the recordings of the Creamback H.
Yeah.
And I then ordered a cab with that combo, and I recommended Misha to get one, and then Mark from Periphery got one. And then suddenly, and this might not have anything to do with us, I mean, I know that for Zilla, it's continued to be a really popular combination, as evidenced by the guy earlier who was asking, you know, saying about exactly that. And yeah, it seemed to have kind of become a thing, like a 212 with a Vintage 30 and a Creamback H. I don't know if it came from, you know, all the way back to me, as it were, but it definitely is a combination that people like at this point. I don't really like them that much on their own, though, the Creamback H. Sounds good in a combo, I think, but I would never choose, if I just had one mic and a cab with both speakers, I would never put it on the Creamback H.
Oh, okay.
I'd always put it on the Vintage 30, I think.
Dimitri Butko, hey guys, Nolly, what do you think of the EVH 5150 Stealth compared to the PV5150?
Right, well, you guys will probably know about this because you've had James Brown on. There's like a really big difference between a 5150 and a 5152, or like a 6505.
Yep.
And a 6505 plus.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it seemed, I think the story came out on your podcast of James Brown saying that like somebody made a mistake and put the wrong coupling cap in, like a 2N2 instead of a 22N when they did the Mark II. And Eddie ended up liking that one amp and that became the new setting. But like that first coupling cap, you know how in an SLO,
the first coupling cap is smaller
all the way through.
Yeah, it's a smaller and much smaller in the two.
So that lineage carried through into the EVH amps.
Mm-hmm.
So all the EVH amps have that 2N2
yep.
coupling cap there.
I think it's even smaller now. Okay.
Is it smaller now?
No, I think like it. Yeah, I think so. I don't know.
Is it a 500 PF?
Something like that. Yes.
I think 500 PF.
Like, or maybe really the original 5152 was a 750 PF or something like that. I haven't looked at the schematic in a while, but yeah,
I just remembered what it is. So in the original SLO, there's a treble peaker.
Yeah.
Like SLO that got carried over into 5150 of like,
2N2.
470 meg with a with a
470K
1000 PF over it?
No, I think it's a 2N2.
Okay. And then later down the chain is all 2N2 coupling caps. And in the 5152, that little treble peaker is replaced with just a 500 PF.
Right.
Like really choking it.
Yeah.
And then the next coupling cap is a 2N2. So anyway, point being, if you're talking, if the question is referring to a 5152 or a 6505 plus, that's a lot closer to the modern EVH amps in terms of like the red channel.
Except I find stealth has way too much gain.
I'd agree. And I think that 500 PF or 470, whatever it is, that coupling cap is choked to the point where if you do put a tube screamer in front of it, like so many people do in metal, it's just, it's not got any low end left. It just kind of sounds weird and gargly in the mids.
Mm.
If you play directly into them, like bands like Gojira do, they don't tend to use like boost pedals most of the time. And you're using a pickup that's not throwing out loads of low end, or you're not using really thick strings, that can work quite well. And I think those sound really good in that context. I personally would be perfectly happy with a 5150 and a 5152 and not bothering with the EVHs, but I think they sound really cool. And obviously they have better clean channels and better crunches on the EVHs. Like, I think the other channels have been figured out a lot better. Yeah, I mean, they're all great amps. You can get great sounds out of all of them.
Yep. Alexander Shabilsky, thanks for the super chat. Great show. Thank you.
Sweet.
Steve C, curious about what you gentlemen think of Scumbag Speakers' take on vintage Celestions.
Oh, they're quite good, actually. In the early days, so they were made by Weber Speakers originally, and I remember in the early days, A being some like just standard greenback versus his I used to like the 65 M65 version,
which isn't 65. I get confused with his like numbers.
It's 65 watts.
It's 65 watts, but it's replicating a 25 watt
system. It's a greenback, but it has a 65 watt capability. He also makes one that's lower in wattage. But,
see, I don't get that. Like, how does that change the voicing?
I don't know, but the 65 watt is what I liked at the time. And when we compared it directly to an old greenback, it was just better. It was just the low end stayed less garbled, less kind of confused sounding. And the top end was just a smidge sweeter. And it just... It's really good. I mean, he does a good. I mean, he did a lot of research on making him. Had a lot
I've
of.
I've only had a few experiences with them, and I thought they sounded great, but yeah, I've not had the really opportunity. Good. And I just find the model lineup confusing. Like, I've thought a couple of times, like, oh, I should buy some, and then I go on the site, and I'm like, I have no idea what to buy. You know, between the different wattages.
We're gonna have him on the show, actually, but
he's coming on. He's coming on February 23rd.
Great. Maybe ask him what to buy, and I'll buy a quad from him.
Right, he's our next guest, actually.
Oh, I mean, that would be good. That would be good to do. Even like, you know, obviously, you're going to think of more cab packs and more things to do in the future. You know, and it'd be good to mix them up and do some different speakers and do some things.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
That'd alternate cool. takes on it.
For sure.
Cool. Have you done any EVs?
No, I've not. We've not included any EVs. I think you weren't here, and I was just saying that like the things we've done at least so far have all been stuff that I've been like really inspired and on like a personal tone mission on. EVs have never been part of that mission. I kind of know what they sound like, but I don't feel that like doesn't make my heart race when I hear it.
It's sort of funny though. It does a thing. It does a thing, and there was a you know a lot of rock guitar players that used to use them. And it does a thing, and for high gain stuff too. I have one EV in for the pedal. I have one EV cab in it.
Yeah.
And if you put it on at first, you're like, okay, that's darker, and that's this. But then if you go in my settings and like up the thump switch and up the presence on it, then all of a sudden it becomes like this more metal sort of punchy. With more sizzle and everything, and it works really well.
Yeah.
Neil Giraldo.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they've been used for some incredible tones.
Yeah.
You know, from Mark Wilde, Neil Giraldo, like Jakey Lee. Well.
All those Jakey Lee. EVs. Oh, yeah.
Jakey Lee. Interesting. Strachak.
You gotta get old ones.
Love the show. So much great info. Love the 80s and all the old times, but no way to get this much insight back then. Thank you all. Oh, thank you. Yeah, those, I guess Guitar World magazine didn't provide all this detail back then, huh?
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah. Like we're in like an age of enlightenment at the moment with regards to guitar tones. Like everything's getting accessible to everyone and like things are being figured out. Like, oh, so that's why that always sounded that way. And like, oh, that's how you get that sound. And it's kind of cool, I think.
Yeah. There's also a lot of misinformation.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I think, and there's also, I think, a lot of forgotten information that you literally can't even find anymore on the internet. It's interesting.
Is there something in your head that you're thinking about when you say that? Like,
nothing off the top of my head right this minute, but there was a time on the internet there was more, even like, so say you're into making amps, or say you're into tweaking amps or things. There was a point on the internet where there was so much information out there on little things.
A lot of forums shut down.
A lot of forums, but that information went away.
Right.
And you can't find it anymore, and there isn't any information on it anymore out there. And it's like I always find that interesting. As it progressed, it's gotten more informative and less informative at times. But I kind of look at this show as like kind of we're the history curators, so to speak.
Yeah.
Of you know, like you know, I've told people before, I go, come on the show and here's why. And you know, it's like these stories are going to be lost forever. You're never, you know, they're either, when you die, they're gone. And you know, some of this story should be told. Some of these,
I totally agree. And I think so much of the time, like engineers and creators, like they don't really think to do that.
Yeah.
Think, you know, and I agree. And even doing the IRs with something like speakers, you're like, this is a degradable object. You know? Mm-hmm. It, like if you're taking IRs of like a 67 Greenback, you're like, this has lived a long time already, and we now have the opportunity to like
capture,
just hold it in time. It's not 100% perfect replica of it, but there is an element of like, yeah,
archiving. It's close.
Same idea.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Well, thanks, Straight Strat Jacket. I was going to call you Straight Jacket. Christian Daniel again. Nolly, your tone inspiring, sir. Guys, is there any album you would use today for reference, a good bass guitar recording to go off of? Any genre? Thanks.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty wide.
Any genre? Well, that's tough because there's different styles of bass playing and there's different styles of everything.
Well, just recently, I mean, well, is it modern? What did you say?
There's one bass tone off the top of my head that stands out to me as the great quintessential sort of P bass SVT sort of sound. And that's the beginning of Filter's song, A Nice Shot or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And when you, Hey Man, Nice Shot, you know, whatever that song was actually called. Yeah. And it starts with bass, just clear bass. And it just has this, you know, it's a pick P bass SVT. It's a classic rock thing.
Yeah.
Also the Offspring had a song that was like that too, that started with the bass at the beginning. That was a really killer. It was also a P bass.
In a similar genre, I was going to say it's a J bass, I'm pretty sure. Less Than Jake. This is a really, I don't know why this is coming to my head, but Less Than Jake, the Hello Rockville record starts. What's the first song called? Last One Out of Liberty City. That's a CLA mixed record. And I don't necessarily always think about CLA for bass tones, but that literally starts with like the riff is played on bass. And that's always a bass tone like I can just picture in my head all the time. It's quite clean, pretty compressed, but like you can really hear a J bass character in there. In my genre, there was an album that came out that changed everything, which was Carnival's record, Sound Awake, an Australian band, huge in Australia.
Yeah, I know who they are.
You know, kind of desperately not well known enough over here. And with the producer, Forrester at the helm, they created some of the most incredible bass tones. So if you listen to that record, even like the first two tracks is very prominent bass, and it's just like really glorious, distorted bass sound, like so warm and clear and like satisfying. And then Meshuggah in like the progressive metal genre, like
yeah.
their bass tone, which is very much like when a bass distortion sounds a lot like a guitar distortion, and what happens when you then put that with guitars. Mm-hmm. I think they describe their bass tone as someone dragging an oil tanker across a rubble field or something like that. Like, this just sounds like the most Titanic kind of scraping industrial noise. I feel like we're forgetting about so many brilliant bass tones.
Doug Pinnock from King's X always has a brilliant distorted sort of bass tone that's always great.
Yeah.
Lemmy from Motorhead always had just an unbelievable ratty, thrashy, distorted bass tone that was cool. You know,
I'm a fan.
We're forgetting about a ton of them, but
I mean, Geddy Lee's bass playing, not the playing, but his tone. I like Geddy Lee's
bass
tone.
Sure. I like it when I can hear the bass.
Yeah,
I like it when it's got a ratty distortion to it, and you can kind of hear that with the guitars. You know, I love where it's cutting through. You're actually hearing it. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
James Jamerson. I love
for sure.
Yeah.
The 470 PF is the one from the 5150 combo.
Oh yeah, just the first.
Pretty positive. It's also in the Mark II, because I think those came around at a similar time, didn't they?
Yeah. Mm,
okay. Yeah. I think it just kind of took over at that point.
John DeShane, great show as usual. Thank you. Dave, would it be beneficial to get a power station and crank the balls off my BE-100 Deluxe to get into Plex territory and feel? No.
Well, okay. So, first off, the amp is sort of just is a preamp-based amp designed. That's where you're getting your gain from. When you have a really a higher gain channel like that, and then you're adding power amp distortion to it, it's too much. It sounds like shit. Now, if you wanted to use the clean channel on the amp, the Plexi channel, and crank it into a power station, you could. And you would get more of a classic super lead power amp distortion thing. Hmm. If you did that, I would turn the thump knob off. Because you don't need any of that either for that kind of tone. Hmm. So no, it's not necessary.
And so it's an interesting thing. So my B100 is 2016,
mm-hmm.
and I was the second owner, and the first owner had been using it for very Plexi style tones,
mm-hmm.
and they'd given it back to, I forget the name of the tech in London at the time that was doing the repairs and mods in the UK.
Oh, was that? Was it people that we used?
I think it was like your guy, as I understood it.
Oh yeah, that was Rob Moss. Yeah.
To be honest, I don't even know if I'd recognize the name. Yeah. But yeah. He'd done something to it because that guy had been saying, obviously you've got two gain stages
before. Oh, I know what this is. I know what you're gonna say. He'd done something to it to make it a little more Plexi like.
Yeah, yeah.
I know what he did. There's a cathode cap. Okay. I think he did it on the very first stage of whatever channel. There's, if you're on the HBE channel, that's another stage in front of that. But say you're on the BE channel, I'm pretty sure the 0.68 cathode cap that's on the cathode 2.7K cathode resistor, he partially bypassed it. So he put like a 1K resistor between the cap and ground. So it just partially buys it, and it rolls a little of the top.
Yeah.
You're still getting the same effect of the cap, but it's just rolling a little of the top end off.
Yeah, because of the coupling cap.
And then he liked that because it was rounder. I remember that.
That's my amp, yeah. So that's
he said it made the guy happy when he did it. So,
and I think at the same time, because I think he added the lower, the B+ switch on it, which was not from the factory. He? Yeah, because it's actually, you can see it's a slightly longer switch.
Okay.
Same logos on it. So it's a bit of a bastardized amp. And I put the kind of fixed thump cap to a 68 like you have on the
068.
Yeah.
I like that. It's
a bit more like sub, a little bit less.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of the stuff I do, like that the palm mute needs to be really tight. And sometimes the 47 can just be a bit too.
Yeah, total sense. Higher. So that's why on the deluxe amps now they have that switch that already on there. Hmm. Actually, kind of
two values on the deluxe.
I kind of prefer, there's three actually, but I kind of prefer the 0068 actually.
Mm.
I think that's me too. That's better.
let's make this our last super chat. It's getting long. I know, Dave, you got to go to work, right?
I got to work.
Yeah. Bruce Hawkins, thanks for the super chat. Happy 2024. Thank you. Or as I like to call it, the year of the Plex. Any chance the mid pot on the Plex is a 50K pot a la Ed's Holy Grail?
It's not, because it's a replication of my amp that I have. So I didn't put it in. I wasn't necessarily going for one thing. I was going for replicating what I have. So it could be. It's not going to make that much of a difference.
It basically is like the range of the mid control, right?
Like, well, when the mid pot's on 10, it lifts the, you know, the mid a little bit more from ground. And by doing that, there's a thing that happens in an old Plexi when like everything is cranked. There's a thing that happens in the treble that it gets almost like a what do I call it? Crashing kind of sound to it. And if you roll the treble back to 8, that goes away. And you can see it on a scope, actually, too. You can see what's happening. It's almost sort of like taking the mid down. When you add the 50K pot, that all goes away, because right. It fills it in, sort of, so to speak. And but mine doesn't do it that much. So even on this new amp, you can see it. But if you backed it maybe to 9, it would go away completely. So I just wanted to make it like the amp I own.
I wanted to comment on one thing to do with Eddie and mid-pots. On the 5150, I think one of the interesting quirks with it is, well, it's 25K with a 25K resistor across it, which changes the taper of it, right?
Oh, yeah. No, so I thought it's like more sensitive.
Is it 50 with a 50? You might be right.
Maybe it's a 50 with a 50. That's a good question. Yes, well, that'll change
the way it sweeps, right?
Yeah, that'll change the way it sweeps a little. Yeah.
Like, it's going to be sensitive around the middle, and then you often see people with really extreme settings on the mid.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, if you try that on an amp model where I guess they haven't replicated that sweep behavior, it doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
You know? And obviously in the other ones, the weird presence pot where they've used to.
All right, we're really geeky about all this.
Yeah. Well, Nolly, it was fantastic having you on the show, man. What a great discussion with you and getting to know you. And thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Send me an email. We'll talk about the cabs and stuff.
For sure. I'd love to send you guys whatever you want. Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to promote or talk about before we head off into our weekend?
I feel like I probably promoted my speakers and Dave's amps as much as I promoted it.
Well, hey, it's fine.
That's awesome.
No, it's all good. Nothing's coming to mind. I'm a bit rubbish like that. Like, I'm just really passionate about the things that I'm passionate about. And sometimes that's products that we have out right now, and sometimes it's other shit.
Awesome.
It's been a pleasure to be on here.
Absolutely. Pleasure. Thanks so much, really. And everybody, as I mentioned earlier, our next guest is going to be Jim from Scumbag Speakers. What's his last name?
Jim Seval.
Mm-hmm. Right. Jim Seval will be on. And we've got that lined up. And then we'll do an Ask Dave, Punish Dave with Questions show eventually and stuff like that. So have a great weekend, everybody. Nolly, stay on while we say goodbye. Okay.
Yeah, I just mentioned it. If there's any like super chats that haven't been answered that were for me, by all means, send them on and I'll answer.
No, I think
we got that in the past.
We got to everything in the super chat. I'm sorry to lots of people in the regular chat that we didn't get to. It's been a busy show. We had lots of questions and stuff. So if anybody does have a question you really want to have answered from Nolly, send it to me at tonetalkmark@gmail.com. tonetalkmark@gmail.com. And I'll pass it over. All right. All right, guys. Have a good one. Take care.
You too.
See you.